There is a bill at the Utah legislature this year that would pave the way for Utah to get a statewide lottery. A lawmaker from Morgan, Utah, Representative Kira Birkeland, has been making this case. She says Utahns spend something like $200 million a year to buy lottery tickets outside of the state. So why not keep the money and put it to good use here, like other states do, to fund education and mass transit and homeless services? The good use Birkeland has in mind isn't for parks or wildlife programs or pensions for firefighters. It's tax relief. She says, let's set up a statewide lottery and use the money to give people a break on their property taxes. Utah is one of five states that don't have a lottery. And the reason has a lot to do with this long-standing religious objection to games of chance, that they exploit the poor and vulnerable, that they undermine the work ethic, attract all the bad vices. The LDS Church has been steadfastly opposed to a lottery, and the idea has never gotten very far here. Birkeland's bill has been stuck in a House committee for weeks, and even if it did make it out and get debated, no one thinks it would have any chance of passing. And you want to know how serious Utah leaders have been about their objection to a lottery? They put it in the state constitution. Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune told us that. He says gambling was on the agenda when the delegates got together in the city and county building in 1895 to hammer out the constitution.
So toward the end of the constitutional convention, the delegates are going through the various sections, and they get to this section that would outlaw games of chance. It's day 40. They've been there a long time. And one of the members rises and says, do we really need this? The federal government has already, as he put it, declared war on lotteries. Other states, he said, aren't going down this route. And another member rises and says, you know, he hears from his friends in North Dakota. They adopted a constitution without this section in it. And he says he's hearing from his friends that these people from Louisiana, these influences from Louisiana are coming in with their money and so forth, trying to convince the North Dakota legislature to adopt a lottery. And his opinion was that we should leave it in rather than leaving the door open at all. Just shut the door, leave this section in there, and ban all games of chance. And this delegate Hammond rises and he says, let me ask the gentleman from Weber a question. Will this prohibit horse racing? He says, I'm very fond of horse racing. I never bet much on it, but I am fond of it. And he gets this response, no, it will not, according to the construction of the courts. And he says, then I am satisfied. And they go ahead and vote on this, leave the section in there banning these games of chance, lotteries, casinos, and not horse racing. Horse racing remains legal in the state until 1913. At that point, the legislature sees that they're getting some scurrilous sort of nefarious influences into the sport, and they decide they're going to outlaw it. About a decade later, they come back and say, no, we're going to set up this parimutuel betting board to govern parimutuel betting, making it legal. It goes up to the Utah Supreme Court, and the Utah Supreme Court points to this exchange during the Constitutional Convention and says, well, no, clearly they did not mean to outlaw horse racing, so, you know, it's fine. Go ahead and do it. A couple years later, the legislature came back, reversed course, outlawed parimutuel betting, and ever since then, all forms of gambling have been illegal in the state of Utah, and Utah is kind of unique in that regard. It's one of two states, along with Hawaii, that have no forms of legalized gambling. And now we have Representative Kira Birkeland, who says that based on what she's hearing from her constituents, they want a lottery. You know, we see during the Powerball craze, all of these cars traveling north to Idaho. You know, you go into the parking lots and you see Utah plates everywhere up there. All these people buying lottery tickets and taking their money with them and investing it in Idaho schools, essentially. And so she says, why not keep some of that here? Let's put it to voters. Let them decide, do they want a lottery or not? And if we do have this lottery, we make this money, we can start using it to give people a little bit of property tax relief down the road.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So we're talking about state lotteries today, how they work in other states. In other words, do they actually work to provide money for roads and education and parks? Again, no one thinks a Utah lottery bill is going to get anywhere. But like the lottery, there is a chance, a very, very, very remote chance. Now, remember, the prohibition against lotteries is in the Constitution. So Robert Gerke says Representative Berkland's bill doesn't create a lottery, just a way to get there.
So because the Constitution still bans games of chance, it would say games of chance are prohibited except for a lottery established by the state legislature. And then it would put that constitutional amendment to voters on the next general election ballot. And if a majority of them vote for it, then the legislature could go ahead and set up a lottery however it sees fit. So it's not necessarily, okay, if we vote for this, we automatically have a lottery, but it would definitely clear the way for that to become a reality.
So Representative Berkland isn't thinking about the lottery as a way to fund education, which
right.
is which is what a lot of lotteries do in other parts. Her idea is to lower property taxes?
Yeah, she says the thing she hears about most often from her constituents is that their property taxes are out of control.
Hmm.
And, you know, how do you provide property tax relief? Well, you can raise other taxes, I guess, and bring in money to do that. Sort of defeats the purpose in some in some regards. And so she thinks that this is, rather than sending all this money out of state to Idaho and Colorado, you could impose this lottery or create this lottery, raise perhaps tens of millions of dollars, net tens of millions of dollars, and then put that towards some measure of property tax relief.
Is that a different spin than the case that others have made? Others have said, look, we have needs. Education, as I mentioned, is sort of one of them. But there are other places that fund. I've never heard of it as property tax relief or tax relief.
I think it's – I think it – it is unusual because, as you mentioned, Idaho makes a big deal about how many millions of dollars it sends to their public school system. I think in this state in particular, tax relief is a big seller.
Yeah.
And so I think rather than, you know, send it to schools, which a lot of Republican colleagues feel are probably already well taken care of, let's send it to some place that might help, you know, people on fixed incomes, the elderly, things like that, be able to afford to stay in their homes. And as we've seen in this state in the last decade, housing prices are going through the roof. And that means as your home value increases, your property taxes increase. Mm-hmm. And so people who are, you know, are in these homes on a fixed income maybe can't afford it. It lightens the load a little bit, potentially.
What is the essence of the opposition to a lottery? It has to be centered on the LDS Church, I guess. But it's not really church doctrine. What do you understand about the church's relationship with something like a lottery?
Yeah, I think for, you know, generations, lotteries have been seen as a vice, right? They're seen as something that as people attacks on people who don't understand math, I think they've been called. They've been seen as something that, you know, lazy people do to try to get rich, you know. The LDS Church in particular has been outspoken against this, and while not necessarily doctrinally opposed to it, going back to the time of Brigham Young, he was talking about he wanted to, as he put it, outlaw grog shops and gambling in order to, you know, we wish to suppress all grog shops, gambling houses, and other disorderly houses or proceedings in our city, and to tolerate no intemperance or vice in our midst. You know, so this is something that is deeply rooted in the LDS faith, if not, you know, scripturally, at least from the pulpit. And it's stuck. You know, in the mid-80s, a lottery was very popular, frankly. Public polling showed it polling well over 55% from 1985 to 1995.
Wait, in the 80s, Utahns were for the idea of a lottery?
They wanted the lottery. From 1985 to 1995, every year, a Democratic legislator introduced a bill that would have legalized a lottery, created a lottery. It never went anywhere, of course. And so, you know, these ended up dying. In 1986, the polling that was done in 1986 showed 73% of Utahns supported having a lottery, and the bill that would have enabled a lottery failed 54-12 in the House. And so you can kind of see the disconnect there between the public demand or the public's will in terms of wanting a lottery and the control of the legislature's ability to keep something under wraps, even if the public overwhelmingly wants to have it.
Well, not just the public will in contrast to the way legislators are behaving, but the public will and the way they're church leaders might be behaving as well. Because I'm guessing then it's probably opposition from the LDS Church that killed that idea as well, possibly.
Right, right. And Dan Jones, who was the pollster who, you know, was tracking these numbers, said, this is a quote from him, "Until the predominant church in the state makes a statement in favor of a lottery, there is little chance that one will ever be established. Preliminary public opinion to the contrary." And there hasn't been a serious effort to bring it back since. Senator David Hinkins a few years ago, he actually raises racehorses and breeds them and races them. And he tried to bring it back, but it was sort of a half-hearted effort toward the end of the session. It didn't really go anywhere. It's sort of been a dead issue since 1992.
How do you understand the – I'm not sure how to put this – how the morality – set aside the church's opposition to it, which seems to be based on – I suppose there's a sort of a moral concern about it. But let's do talk about the moral part of it. What do you think about that? The idea that it exploits vulnerable people.
I think the image that a lot of opponents of gambling have in their head is somebody who can't afford to lose the money, but is putting, you know, instead of buying groceries, is taking this money and buying lottery tickets in hopes that they're going to get rich one day, you know, and obviously the math works against them in that regard. I think they see it as a way to sort of it's undermining that puritanical work ethic that we have in this country, that ethos of, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Rather than pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you're going to try to win some bootstraps in the lottery. So it's always been seen as sort of the easy way, a shortcut. And, you know, now that's the lottery. And when you then when you get into sort of the perceptions we have of casino gambling and horse racing, the mob influences there that are sort of, you know, legendary. I think that there's just sort of this seedy underbelly in the gambling world generally that is problematic. But, you know, Utah also has this history of, you know, underground gambling. It has you know, the bingo nights,
lots of raffles,
you know. So there is gambling that goes on. And now we've got this whole new Pandora's box opened up with the sports betting apps that, you know, while technically you're not supposed to do it in Utah, a lot of people do. And, you know, you can bet on anything from the comfort of your home now. And so I think it's really confronting that traditional images we have of the gambling world, you know, it's challenging the notions that we've held for decades and decades.
You know, it's interesting. You talked with Representative Berkland, and one of the things she told you as a way of sort of justifying or explaining away the concern that this exploits vulnerable people, read poor people. She said that she would, as she's sort of framing this, she's thinking, well, what we do, she told you, is we will sell these lottery tickets in upper class neighborhoods, not in lower class neighborhoods. What do you make of that?
Yeah. Well, and I asked her about the potential vice argument, and she kind of dismissed that out of hand. She said she doesn't think people are actually going to put more money into the lottery than they can afford to lose. And then she said that because it's state run, it would be, you know, the state would license places to sell the tickets and they can choose where those places are going to be. You can actually put these places in upper class neighborhoods. Now, I don't know that upper class neighborhoods are necessarily going to be keen on that either, you know, but it's the way that she thinks that she can get around or at least blunt that argument against the lottery. Again, this is all sort of conjecture at this point because this bill hasn't had a committee hearing. I'm not sure it's going to get a committee hearing. You know, the leadership over in the Senate has already said the chances of it passing are about as good as the chances of winning the lottery at this point. So the chances of it actually going anywhere might not be good. But she's thought about that issue and thinks that if you focus primarily on better off neighborhoods, you're going to be able to alleviate a lot of the concerns about that. Will remains to be seen if it does.
There's another so-called vice that Utah leaders and lawmakers haven't had a problem benefiting from. It's alcohol. The tax on liquor makes $500 million for the state these days, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. How do you explain that contradiction?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Utah has always had a sort of fraught relationship with alcohol, right? Yeah. I mean, we were the state that put the repeal of prohibition over the top, but we've also always maintained very tight control over it. I think that the legislature has largely accepted that alcohol is here to stay. Mm-hmm. It's in recent years, it's the argument in favor of loosening the liquor laws is that we want to be more welcoming to outsiders, right? The lottery is a little bit different, I guess, in that respect, in that you're selling those tickets to people who live in your neighborhoods and communities. But they make hundreds of millions of dollars off of alcohol sales, and there's no sign of them doing anything to try to diminish that. Yeah. You know, it's one of those trends that is continued in a straight line for, you know, as Utah grows, liquor sales grow. And so, but, you know, you can also, when you look at the vice element of it, there's a lot more negative effects of alcohol than there probably are with a lottery. I mean, domestic violence, alcohol is a leading precursor of that. Obviously, drunk driving is an issue, you know, on and on. You can go down the ills of demon rum, but it's something that the legislature has accepted, and it doesn't show any signs of lessening its presence here in Utah. If anything, it's probably growing.
Could Utah make a lot of money off a lottery?
Could make an awful lot of money. Nationally, 2021 is the most recent figures we have that the Census Bureau collected. And nationally, there were $95.6 billion, billion with a B, of lottery tickets sold in the United States. So, you know, you pay out prizes off of that. You ended up bringing in about $27 billion to the states that are operating these. Just our neighboring states, Idaho, it sold $343 million, so about a third of $1 billion worth of tickets, netted $72.5 million. As I mentioned, most of that is earmarked for Idaho schools. And so, you know, that's kind of the order that we're talking about. Colorado sold $734 million in tickets and brought in $167 million in revenues. And so it's a sizable chunk of money. It's nothing to scoff at. And so, you know, then you start talking about, okay, we've got 3.4 million Utahns. You start spreading that money around, and you could actually see it have a pretty profound impact when you're talking about trying to alleviate the property tax burden on some people.
Representative Berkland knows legislative leaders are dubious.
Yeah.
But she has said she thinks the people of Utah want this. Do you think she's right about that?
You know, there hasn't been polling done recently on it. But I think that there, if you put this to a vote, I think there's a good chance that you would see a pretty positive outcome. I think that that's always the question, though, when you're dealing with the legislature, right? She thinks that the legislature is going to be responsive to its constituents. I think a lot of times that is the case that they are. But when you get into these issues of morality and issues that particularly when the LDS Church is involved, we saw it with, for example, the medical marijuana debate, right? The polls had showed for years that there was a majority support for that. And then, you know, the legislature wouldn't do it until it got to the ballot. So it's one of those things where public support doesn't always equate to public policy.
Yeah.
And so there are some big hurdles that she's going to have to overcome in that respect.
So if the motive in the past against a lottery had been a moral one, now it seems like the motive is financial. She sort of twisted that to alleviate property taxes for Utahns. So could that be an opening for a lottery? As you say, could lawmakers be amenable to the idea of, man, if I can get a break in my property taxes, I'd buy a $10 lottery ticket every once in a while, I suppose.
There's nothing that lawmakers like more than cutting taxes in this state. And so especially in an election year, if they could go to their constituents and say, hey, we gave you an opportunity to reduce your own property taxes with this, I think that would be a big selling point for her. And I think, frankly, if this were to come up for a vote in the House, she would have a very good chance of getting it through. I think the Senate's the real question right now. and you know, going back to those comments from Senate leadership, they don't think much of it. But you know, I think in the House in particular, when these guys are going out to their constituents later this year to ask for their vote for reelection, yeah, they would love to have, you know, we gave you an opportunity to cut your property taxes by X percent, and it's a pretty powerful selling point, I think. Probably more powerful putting it into a tax cut than, say, you know, putting it into education in this state.
Is it kind of silly for us to even be having the conversation given the chances? I mean, beyond indulging it as a kind of novelty. I mean, you have the influential LDS Church, which I'm sure is opposed.
Yeah.
You have a sort of a minor player, frankly, in Representative Berkland who's marshaling the bill. You have no support among leadership. Yeah. At least certainly in the Senate. So, you know, like, what's the point of even talking about something like this?
Well, I think it's worth talking about because it's something we've been talking about since 1895, yeah, since the Constitutional Convention. Are we going to be bamboozled by these slick Easterners and these Louisianans and so forth, you know? Or you know, is it as deleterious to our communities as maybe it's been made out to be? It's hard to argue now when we have so many states, when we have 45 states plus District of Columbia that run the lottery, that, you know, they've managed to keep things together a little bit. They're not Sodom and Gomorrah necessarily. I don't think last time I was in Malad buying a lottery ticket that, you know, there was hailfire and brimstone falling on it. So you know, we need to challenge these preconceived notions we've got every couple decades, I guess. And so bringing it up, I think it at least creates an interesting conversation and probably one that we need to have.
Robert Gerke, thanks a lot.
Yep, thanks, Doug.
Robert Gerke, he's with the Salt Lake Tribune. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're imagining, what if Utah had a lottery, like most of the rest of the states in the country? Now, the truth is, it's not going to happen. Even though there is a bill at the legislature this year proposing one, as Robert Gerke told us, its chances are about the same as winning the lottery, which is not nothing, I guess, and maybe the ground is shifting. Anyway, it's worth discussing why citizens and states, except a rare few, continue to bet their dreams on winning the big one. Jonathan Cohen is a writer who's been exploring lotteries in the country, and he begins his book with a story of a man he says is the typical American who, despite some really steep odds, continues to buy lottery tickets. Leo McCord is his name. And Cohen says he fits the type to a T.
He is an older African-American man, lower to medium income, completed some college but didn't graduate, and has been playing the lottery almost every day since 1974. He sees it, and this is something that's hard for people who aren't lottery players to imagine, he sees it as a form of entertainment, and he truly feel that he derives entertainment value out of it in the way that some people might go to the movies. And even with, you know, a $100,000 windfall that he won in 2009, he knows that he's lost more than he's won, but the dream is sort of what keeps him coming back. And it's not just sort of that moment when you're scratching the scratch tickets or you're looking up the numbers for the drawing. It's sort of the anticipation, the hours before, the minutes before, when you have this sort of skin in the game and as a result have the chance to sort of legitimately imagine what it would be like to win the lottery.
So you sometimes hear, and we've heard it recently actually, that it's the saying that says lotteries are a tax on people who are bad at math. But you say that it's not fair to say that, and it's not really true that people who play the lottery, they get it. They understand their chances, but they play anyway. Explain that.
Yeah. And this is right. This is, I think the common assumption is that these people, you know, a less kind way, a version of that phrase is that it's a stupid tax.
Yeah.
Is that someone like Leo McCord just doesn't get how probability works and simply doesn't understand that his odds are bad. And he knows full well that his odds are bad. And you can tell this in part because the most popular lottery game in the country are scratch tickets, which have the best payout ratio. So people are sort of, quote unquote, as rational economic actors, gravitating towards the games that provide the best payout. But the essence of the answer to your question is that this is not like they failed a high school statistics course and therefore are going to buy lottery tickets. This is because they know their odds are bad and that they still reason that the lottery is, you know, by their estimation, their last, best, or only chance at a new life, at the American dream. You can imagine how much else must be going wrong with their life, with their economic situation, with their feelings of political voice, that they feel like they have to turn to the lottery because it provides something that they aren't getting anywhere else. They know the lottery has a 1 in 302 million chance, if you're talking about, you know, a game like Powerball, but they feel like they have a 0.0 chance sort of through the traditional economy, through work, through entrepreneurship. So as terrible as the lottery odds are, they're better than what they're getting anywhere else.
How many people buy lottery tickets? How many Americans, give or take?
Well, every year, it's about 1 in 2. 50% of Americans buy a lottery ticket once a year, and then 1 in 8 do so at least once a week. So we're talking about a lot of people who have turned to the lottery as their source of dreams.
I wanted to ask you about what seems like this kind of theme that goes along with the lottery. You say that in the book that the word itself comes from a word that means someone's lot in life, that they're due. And you say Americans see a lottery as kind of this chance to be, as you put it, chosen by luck or chosen by God or whatever, you know, whatever you believe in, whatever force is behind all of this. How does that work? How are you thinking about that, this idea that we want to be chosen by some force?
Yeah, I think this is another difference between the lottery and other forms of gambling, other forms of play, other forms of upward mobility, which is some people might like get a great job, work really hard, make a lot of money, and feel like they were chosen by God. But it's not the same as defying probability into such a crazy mathematical degree that you won a Powerball, right? That you feel like the odds are so bad that some people sort of have come to reason that the only way, you know, obviously somebody somewhere sometime has to win. But the fact that you today won with those numbers, some people just sort of can't fathom the fact that it was random and sort of ascribe that to heavenly forces or divine forces. But I think it also sort of speaks more broadly what you're referring to this sort of national clinging to the idea of a meritocracy, that people who are rich, people who are wealthy, people who have made it deserve their wealth. And the lottery is the very opposite of a meritocracy. It is a randomocracy. Mm. And so I think people like to justify and like to reason that if they won the lottery, oh, it wasn't just because of randomness. It was because I was due. It was because I deserved it somehow. It wasn't just luck. It was about God or something else.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned that this idea of a lottery is not new. It's pretty ancient. And you describe how the first lotteries, you know, were thousands of years ago, and in some cases they were a way of, you say, discerning divine will. Explain that.
Yeah, I mean this is we're talking literally, you know, in the Bible, lotteries aren't yet games of chance. They are serious divinatory practices to determine. Some examples are, you know, the allotment of the land of Israel for the 12 Israelite tribes, or, you know, the target of an invasion. And the idea being that, you know, some characters in the Bible can pray and God will answer their prayers, but many others sort of see divine providence written into randomness. And so they'll cast lots or they'll throw stones or whatever the case may be to, on the assumption that there actually isn't randomness, that it's actually God who's sort of holding their hand or guiding their hand or guiding the dice, or whatever, as the case may be. But it gets exactly to your point that there is this belief that there's something else than just pure luck happening with these drawings.
So when did, as sort of these civilizations develop governments and governments need to, you know, serve their citizens, they need to build roads and, you know, infrastructure, all those kinds of things. When did governments first start using lotteries to fund those kinds of programs? Now, this goes back a ways, too.
That's right. And so there's some belief that I haven't been able to verify that the lotteries were used even to fund the construction of the Great Wall of China. Funds drawn from a lottery. But the first sort of modern iteration that I can sort of verify were in 15th century Europe, in Genoa and Belgium, for exactly this purpose, sort of started by initially as sort of a gimmick, as a game by private companies that the city-states or that the local government sort of realized were a moneymaker, and they would use lotteries for the purposes of public defense or other sort of civic needs. And that as an idea sort of gradually caught on for the same reason they appeal now. It's one of few ways that government can raise money without taxes. The 15th century Genoans were just as good about raising taxes as we are and paying for things, I guess.
Yeah. So in the colonial period of America, there were lotteries. I've heard it described as, you don't put it this way in your book, but I've heard it described that it was like a civic duty if you were a colonist to participate in a lottery because you were funding, you know, the community or eventually even the revolution. Is any of that true?
Yeah. I mean, you can imagine that if you're at war with Britain because you are angry about taxes, the new government is not going to be super keen on raising taxes to pay for that war. And as I said, you sort of need to fund the government somehow. You need to fund the Continental Army, the Continental Congress, or you know, and later, you know, the early United States. And a lottery, is one of few ways otherwise to raise money for government. And this is not just even for sort of revolutionary purposes, even into the early years of the Republic. Bridges, roads, universities, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, you know, sort of all these places are raise money through lotteries. And you would, in the earlier colonial period, sort of petition the local or the state government to have a lottery, and they would more often than not approve it. And then you would go out and raise money for your church with a lottery. And exactly as you say, it was sort of seen both as a game and sort of a gamble and a fun way for people to participate in, but also the purpose of the lottery and what you're raising money for was sort of always front and central to the advertising. So whether that's just sort of to get the anti-gambling crusaders off their backs or whether that was sort of genuinely, you know, front of mind for people, I don't know, but it was always sort of part of the narrative and part of the story. Was it was not just Americans like to play the lottery, but at least they like to tell themselves they were playing the lottery for a good purpose rather than just to try to get rich for themselves.
Right. So lotteries are widespread in the early days of the U.S., but you write about how in the 1800s, the tide starts to turn against them. And so then we get to this period where I guess it goes underground. And you write about the kind of precursors to the modern lottery system. Let's talk a little bit about this. This gets going. I'm not sure what the time frame is here, but this is where we get to the numbers games. Talk about this. How does this fit?
Yeah, so these are numbers games, and you know, state lotteries have been more than happy to sort of offer legalized versions of this for the last 50 years or so. But these games have their initial origin in I think around in Chicago, maybe around the 1870s, in a game called Policy, and then get their modern and, you know, much improved, I would say, incarnation in Harlem, emerges in Harlem in the mid-1920s. And these are daily 3 or 4 digit numbers games that can be played for as little as a few pennies. And the neighborhoods would just be covered in numbers runners and sort of people. And Malcolm X did this when he was a kid, and so did Ella Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. Who would sort of collect bets, and you'd have these sort of rings that would cover a neighborhood or a city or even a region. And these games were ubiquitous, particularly in urban black communities, also all different parts of the country. And they were lots of people's sort of first exposure to gambling.
All right. So I want to get to the point where we sort of are now. So let's you mentioned in the book that it's not just, of course, gamblers who get caught up in the fantasy of the lottery. It's also states themselves that try to hit the jackpot, as you put it. So this is a gamble for governments as well, right? They want in on the act,
yeah.
I guess.
Right. So, yeah, and there's a couple of things here, right? First is exactly as you say. They see all this gambling happening, and they reason that Americans are already betting so much.
Yeah.
That they might as well legalize the games and keep the money for the state. So that states weren't saying, oh, we're going to legalize the lottery and it's going to be great. It's going to provide like a nice small drop in the bucket for our revenue. They're saying things, and there's a congressman from New Jersey, I quote, who says exactly this, that we could like increase every state service 4 times over without ever raising taxes thanks to a lottery. Or there's so much money, lottery money out there, we could raise untold millions or hundreds of millions of dollars for the state. They either are purposefully or sort of genuinely and ignorantly exaggerating how much money the lottery would make and what the impact it would be, which is why I sort of equate them with gamblers, in part because it doesn't work in New Hampshire, then it doesn't work in New York, but New Jersey's like, oh, you know, it might as well work for us. And then it doesn't work in Massachusetts, doesn't work in Pennsylvania, but Connecticut still wants to give it a go. One lawmaker's cognitive dissonance is another's perseverance. So they just keep trying and keep sort of betting the farm, pun intended, on the idea that a lottery will finally be a fiscal savior for their state.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those first attempts. So this gets us to 1964, where in the years just sort of right around there, where the state of New Hampshire is trying to start this first state lottery. Talk a little bit about the way it worked. I mean, it wasn't – this was really interesting. It wasn't someone's name that they're drawing out. They connected all of this to a horse race?
Yeah. Oh, my – it's like ridiculous to think about. You'd write your name on a ticket. You'd like keep half the ticket, and then they would draw it. But the drawing wouldn't be, oh, John Smith from Dover, New Hampshire, you won the lottery. It would be of like a horse race, and it would tie your name to a specific horse in a specific historical horse race. And then you'd do like a second drawing, and it would say, oh, in 1946, the third race of the day, the fifth horse won, and that horse is connected to this ticket held by Doreen Johnson from Keene, New Hampshire, and she won the lottery, all of $600,000. So trying to be sort of keep the propriety of the game, you're trying to associate with horse racing, sort of the sport of kings, but you also need to associate with horse racing because there was a federal excise tax on all non-horse race gambling. So in order to avoid basically states paying taxes on lottery revenue to the federal government, they needed to find some backdoor way to tie it to horse racing. So all of this to say the games were ridiculous, and it would not be a surprise to anyone in retrospect that they did not work and that sales were very, very low for the first 6 years of lottery history.
And then there comes this second wave that you write about in the late 1970s when, as you put it in the book, voters are wanting – first of all, they want their taxes cut, but they don't want to give up all the government services. So lotteries become kind of part of this tax revolt, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll just sort of say for additional context that the lotteries had like figured things out a little bit by this time. You know, they added
right, New Jersey really came up with a winning formula.
Right, they do weekly drawings for $50,000 with $1 million drawings here and there. Massachusetts adds scratch tickets in 1974, which sort of really become bread and butter. So these are still not raising the untold millions of dollars that were promised in the 1960s, but they're at least like consistent revenue generators that are not tied to these insane horse race style games. But yes, exactly as you say, in 1978, and sort of most famously with the passage of Proposition 13 in California, states and, you know, really homeowners are sort of rebelling against high taxes, but are repeatedly unwilling to reduce their own government services. And, you know, government has to pay for services somehow. And all of this is sort of creating fertile ground for states that were unwilling to invest in lotteries to finally sort of take the plunge and give it a try on the assumption that they'll take sort of any revenue that they can get.
Jonathan, you said it doesn't work. It doesn't work in New Hampshire, but they tried in New Jersey. Doesn't really work there, but they tried in, you know, Massachusetts or whatever, and it just they keep trying. But what do you mean it doesn't work? Because I think there's an assumption that people are funding, you know, educational services in other states with this money. I mean, yeah, there's a payoff, there's a big lottery, but states are bringing in a lot of money. What do you mean it's actually not working that way?
Yeah, so right. And that's a fair correction, because the lotteries objectively are raising money for states. When I say they're not working, it's they are not meeting the expectations with which they are sort of ushered in. And most people are sort of shocked to hear what a small percentage of every lottery dollar actually ends up going back to the state, and what a small percentage of actual state revenue comes from the lottery. I'm talking about on average nationally, maybe 60% of every lottery dollar goes to prizes, which leaves 25, maybe 30% for actual state revenue. And then on average nationally, maybe 1%, maybe 2% of total state revenue comes from the lottery. This is really a drop in the bucket that, again, it you're right. It does work. It does technically raise money for states, but again, not to the scale that people were hoping. And it is certainly not as impactful as lottery commissions that want you to buy tickets because they are a civic good. It's not nearly as impactful as they would have you believe.
That's Jonathan Cohen. His book is For a Dollar and a Dream, State Lotteries in Modern America. So one of the things that you've talked about is how lotteries in states have kind of been contagious. Like they have this viral quality based on the idea that, you know, that gambling is inevitable. And we'll come back to that premise in a second. But the thing that's happened is, you know, one state legalizes a lottery and it isn't long before, you know, another state does. And this has happened in many places in the country, but it's interesting that it hasn't happened here in Utah, at least not yet.
Right.
And I wanted to know, what did you make of that? Utah so far, at least, hasn't given into the peer pressure. What do you make of that?
Yeah. So there's a couple things going on here. First of all, I should say that the academic study of this issue found that the sort of virality story really is only applicable, they find, for that first wave of lotteries from 1963 to 1977, the first 14 states, that's the only sort of period when the adoption of a lottery in one state sort of has a direct effect on one in neighboring state. I think anecdotal evidence suggests otherwise. And I think every lottery adoption story always is going to have two stories, right? The external story and the internal story. The external story being what's happening in the states around us, and then also what's happening sort of at the national economic level, the macroeconomic level. And then there's also always going to be an internal story. What is happening within the state boundaries, whether it's political, whether it's religious or economic, demographic, for example. You know, just for example, the first states there is a study that shows that the higher percentage of Catholics in a state correlated with earlier adoption of lotteries, because Catholics historically are much more pro-gambling than Protestants are. So we can sort of transport all of that analysis and apply it now to Utah, which is a state that is obviously predominantly majority Mormon. Mm-hmm. Mormons is historically and currently sort of against gambling. Utah and Hawaii are the only two states in the country without any form of legalized gambling whatsoever. You know, horse racing, dog racing, sports betting, sort of lotteries, you name it. And so I think Utah's in this unique position where even if, you know, Nevada doesn't have a lottery, but like, let's be honest, you know, we all, it's not because there's no gambling in Nevada, you know.
Right.
So Utah is on paper, you'd expect from in the external story, they would have had a lottery 40 years ago, but based on the internal dynamics, I think they've been able to resist, and I don't see any reason why that would change unless sort of there's a major demographic swing or the Mormon Church sort of changes its position on gambling in the future.
So you've talked about what you call this really important point in all of this, and it's this idea that gambling is inevitable. So a state is like, look, other people are doing it. We may as well legalize it. It's the same thing that the same sort of justification, I guess, they made with prohibition. Like, everyone's going to drink, so we may as well just control this, make it legal, and, you know, get some tax revenue out of it. So talk a little bit about this idea that gambling is inevitable, because you say gambling shouldn't be thought of as inevitable.
Yeah, or in my classically annoying scholarly way, I'll say yes, but So I think the inevitability argument manifests in two ways. The first is that it is believed that because of numbers games, because of, you know, Louisiana lottery, people making it illegal, exactly as you say, are sort of going to find a way to play anyway, so we might as well legalize it. What happens in practice is that by legalizing it, you get so many people who never would have played if it was illegal. So yeah, for some set of the population, it's inevitable, but for many, many others, it's very evitable. It's very like, you've made it inevitable by legalizing it, by granting them access to the games. This is another, you alluded to sort of my argument about the parallels between states and individuals, and I think this is another case where, just as sort of there's a belief among individuals that gambling is inevitable, so too, oh, Nebraska and Kansas already have a lottery, that means it's surely going to come for us, so we might as well legalize it in Iowa to take advantage, because already all these people in Iowa are going across the border to buy tickets, so we might as well sort of make the money for ourselves. Again, so many more people in Iowa are now going to start buying lottery tickets, but it's sort of hard to justify not doing it. So this idea that gambling is inevitable makes gambling inevitable.
So over the years, you say that the various states who have some form of a lottery, over the last 50 years that you've sort of looked at, they've raised about $250 billion, you know, for education and for roads and all the other kinds of things. But you've also been sort of looking into what the costs of all of that are.
Right.
What are the costs as you see them?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's cost a lot of people a lot to raise a relatively small amount of money for states. You know, yes, $250 billion, I think it is a huge amount of money. I wish I could, you know, even have just 1% of it would be fine with me. But you can imagine sort of how much has been extracted from so many people who needed the money so badly to raise that amount of money. So in order to raise this drop in the bucket, states have had to sort of inflicted untold harm onto families that just simply can't afford how much they've had to pay out. So that's where I didn't come into this story with any bias, with any sort of preconception about whether the lottery is sort of good or bad. But that sort of led me to my conclusion that you're alluding to, which is that lotteries are basically just not worth the cost, and that they're sort of doing more harm than good, and that the cost of sort of raising this relatively paltry amount of money are simply not worth it for American society.
What do you think is the future of lotteries? I mean, I think of sports gambling, for example, because people who gamble in sports, and more people are, of course.
Not in Utah.
They don't.
Or not legally.
But not legally in Utah, right. But the people who do, where they can, they don't think, it seems like anyway, they don't think of it as a game of chance. I mean, you have to do your homework. I mean, you have to look at, you know, the skill set of the various teams. You have to plug in how they play on the road versus how they play at home, and how different players match up and how different teams match up. And if you win, you figure you earned it in a way you might not think of with a lottery. And I'm wondering, if, as sports betting is growing, do you think lotteries will subside?
I think that's a great observation. There's a fundamental difference between something like sports betting, which even if there's lots of luck involved, is sort of perceived as being a game of skill versus a lottery, right? And when you win the lottery, as we've discussed, you can feel sort of chosen or blessed, but you can't feel smart. But when you win a sports bet, you can feel smart.
Right.
There is this phenomenon, maybe at least on the internet, of sports bettors who basically turn sports betting into lotteries by creating these crazy parlays. You know, so rather than just, I think Milwaukee is going to win this game by this many points, it'll be like, I think Milwaukee is going to win this game by this many points, and Giannis Antetokounmpo is going to have at least 15 rebounds, and Brooke Lopez is going to have at least 2 3-pointers, and Damian Lillard is going to have at least 5 assists, and all of a sudden you're talking about 1 in 11,000 odds of winning with a higher payout. So there's nominally skill involved at that point, but you've, again, sort of turned a sports bet into a lottery ticket, which is crazy and weird and fun, and sort of, I think, just to actually come around to your question, sort of speaks to the enduring appeal of the lottery and what the appeal of the lottery is always going to have, in that there are lots of ways in America these days to gamble. You raise sports betting, I would, you know, throw crypto in the mix. I would throw Robinhood into sort of stock trading in the mix. But in all of these ways, even with these sort of crazy sports parlays, you basically need to have a lot of money in order if you want to make a lot of money. The amount you win is sort of roughly proportional to the amount that you bet. But the lottery is different. And the lottery is the only way you can invest $2 and get $1 billion.
Right.
So I think there's a lot to be said about whether scratch tickets are going to go away, whether these sort of other games are going to go away. But Powerball, Mega Millions, I think my grandkids will probably have some version of that, because that is so fundamental and so different. And just people just seem so drawn to it that I think they're going to outlive us all.
Jonathan Cohen, thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug, and good luck.
Jonathan Cohen, his book is For a Dollar and a Dream, State Lotteries in Modern America. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you with ideas or comments or feedback. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.